Thank you very much, Mr. Schmidt. I grew up in the 1960s, and it was a very tumultuous decade. Many of you remember that time period. And having grown up in that decade, it had a profound impact on my life. There were many major events that took place in our history, our nation's history in that decade. We had the assassination of John Kennedy, our president, and a president, someone running for president, rather, his brother Robert. And then later, Martin Luther King as well was assassinated. During that year, that decade rather, there was a great competition between United States, especially, and Russia, and what was called the space race, culminating almost at the end of that decade with the first human to set foot on the moon. Of course, there were many civil rights issues taking place during that time, and also many riots that took place in many areas, as many were trying to fight the inequities that were still prevalent during that time. Many might remember the chaos that descended on the Democrat National Convention in Chicago. And also then America became mired in the Vietnam War, and that legacy still haunts us to this day as a nation. We were on the brink of nuclear war with Russia, having missiles in Cuba, a line drawn in the sand, many will remember that. And then again later in the decade, the Middle East Arab nations invaded Israel. And in a monumental effort by the Israelis, they beat back that whole tide in 7 days. These were all amazing events on the world scene. That time period was also a time period of great growth within God's church. Many people saw these events and other serious events on the world scenes, aspects of the end time as they saw it, and they made a choice. Some of those people were you, or your parents, or maybe even your grandparents. They had to choose to heed the warning going out to the world, or they had to choose to continue to live in the world, hoping that mankind would solve their problems. The end time didn't come in that decade, or the ones to follow. We're still waiting for those major events that God talks about, but the church was not wrong to proclaim an end time message. We were simply premature in the time frame. Being premature, however, gave many a reason to doubt this message at all. And after the great growth of the 1960s, unfortunately, a couple of decades later, many began to fade. It required sacrifice to live God's life, and many got tired waiting. One of the other unfortunate legacies of the 1960s was the development of what is now commonly called the generational gap. Young people were encouraged to question everything the older generations were telling and teaching them. And never before in culture, in our culture especially, was so much thrown off and away, if you will. Social, religious, sexual values were all thrown to the wind. Cultural standards were discarded in spite of a long history of positive influence and consequences in this country. But the consequences of rejecting those right values are all around us now. We have gone from a nation of great emphasis on Christian principles to a nation that lives within the moment. And in many times, not even that. No thought for anything in the future, especially anything spiritually or morally. Because of this, the irony of it is that people have an increasingly hard world to face, not an easier world. Youth today have a hard world to face. It's much different than the world that I grew up in. There's a pressure for drug use and body mutilations in the forms of piercings and tattoos. Premarital sex, along with sexually transmitted diseases that are at an increasingly all-time high and increasingly are incurable. The family structure that used to be the norm and a safe haven prior to the 1950s is increasingly rare. The right answers to all of these problems are all around us. But embracing those answers required choices that require self-sacrifice with a commitment and an obedience to God. A God that as a nation, we increasingly only give lip service to, if that at all. Most of the adults sitting here today have made a choice through the process of baptism to follow God's instruction. What that means is they've sought a choice to change in character according to God's law. But many young people sitting here today, you're in a unique position. I'd like to begin in 1 Corinthians 7. Having come back from the camp meetings, much of this is on my mind. And having gone through this process myself, having grown up in the church, to use our language, I understand while not necessarily the particulars of what many will face that are unique to the challenges today, I understand the process of being in the world but not of the world. In 1 Corinthians 7, verse 14, we're given an interesting statement here by Paul. He's talking to an audience, a pagan culture is what they came out of. They didn't grow up, again, to use our language, they didn't grow up in church. They didn't grow up with a church background. They didn't grow up with the Bible as a standard. And Paul's having to explain many things to them, and he begins here in this chapter to talk about marriage, why it's important, and the natural positive consequences that come from a godly marriage. And in verse 14, then, he makes this statement. He says, "For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife." To put it in a language maybe we're more familiar with, a wife attends church, the husband doesn't. Paul's saying that husband's still set apart by God. Not in exactly the same way as the wife is, but he's set apart nonetheless. And then the opposite is true. The unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Notice why this is important. He says, "Otherwise, your children would be unclean. God wouldn't recognize them." He says, "But now they are holy." That's a profound statement in my estimation. What does it mean to be holy, especially as a young person in God's church? Is that real to you? Do you see yourself as being holy before God? Now, I've mentioned before, and I'll mention it again here, my parents started attending church when I was very young. And in spite of spending the balance of my childhood and the subsequent years growing up in the church, I didn't look at myself as holy. I still don't many times. I saw myself as different. I saw myself as better than the kids at school. I didn't see myself as holy. Quite frankly, I didn't see too many people in the church already grown up who seemed holy. But that's because I was looking at it from a human perspective. The Greek word here, holy, also means to be sacred or consecrated. Do you think of yourself as special or set apart? That's what that word consecrated means, set apart for something special. Do you think of yourself that way? And if not, why? See, the fact of the matter is that holiness is not a matter of anything that we generate. That's why God views our children and us as we come through that baptism process as holy, because He lives in us. It's not a matter of what we generate. If it was, we wouldn't stand a chance of being holy. That holiness comes from God dwelling in us through His Holy Spirit. And that knowledge should change how we view the world, how we face it, instead of just some platitude. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 30. This is one of my favorite scriptures because it crystallizes a thought, if you will, a decision that we have to make of what it is that we're going to follow, what it is that we will base our life on, decisions and choices that we'll make. The whole book of Deuteronomy is a retelling, hence the word Deuteronomy. It's the second giving. God had explained all these things through Moses earlier, but that generation had died. They wandered in the wilderness until they died, and now their children are poised to go into the promised land. And so Moses gives this reaccount. And in Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19, at the end of all of this, basically this discourse on choosing here, Moses, under inspiration of God, says here, "I call heaven and earth as witness today against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing." See, it's really that simple. The world around us doesn't look like death, but it leads to that. We'll come back to that thought in a moment. But our choices really are that pointed. We're choosing either life or death, blessing or cursing. And God doesn't leave us floundering, wondering which is the better. Because He says, therefore, choose life. That's what I want you to have. That's why God created us. He says, choose life that both you and your descendants may live. See, even going all the way back to Genesis 2, we touched on there earlier. When God brought Adam and Eve forward, if you will, when He was having these discussions on the Sabbath day and these one-to-one conversations, part of what He was explaining to them with those two trees is you have to choose. I've given you everything good here. But you still have to choose if this is what you want. Now, the other choice is not a good choice. I'll tell you that up front, but it's your choice. And it won't be without consequences. That's really what God was telling them. And whereas the rest of the world is depending upon God's calling to be part of the body of Christ, for the majority of mankind, that won't happen in this lifetime. For some, it has. And for you young people, especially sitting here today, you're in a unique position to choose, to have access to knowledge that will bring life, as it says here in Deuteronomy. You have opportunity now to practice a holy way of life, along with your parents and the other adults here, and to be part of those first fruits that we rehearse in days like Pentecost and other holy days. God will use us, all of us, that yield to His way of life to teach the rest of mankind a better way of life. My wife and I were talking about this coming down from Oshkosh Church today. You know, reading sad stories this past week about men and women returning from various military actions and they're dealing with I always get it mixed up in my head. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, because they can't unsee, they can't unthink the things they've been exposed to in these horrible situations. So today we're going to focus primarily on the youth. And three different things I'm going to bring to you today. The first is to rehearse some of the struggles this generation faces, especially so that those of us older don't think that it's just simple life. Secondly, what we as parents and older members of the faith can do to help you that are younger. And then lastly, point three, the positive influence the church can be to you now in God's church, helping you choose the course in life that you should take. For those that like a title, you can write this down. My title is Choose This Day. Choose This Day. All right, let's turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3, my first point. 2 Timothy chapter 3 expresses what the end time world will look like. 2 Timothy 3, point number one is struggles that our youth are facing. This is the world we're looking at. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. Hard times. Times of great discomfort. And times of a world that is living apart from God that will become so broken they have no idea how to fix it. Verse 2. For men will be lovers of themselves. And that can take many different expressions, whether it's egocentric or whether it's just seeking pleasure in general or whether it's just living for the moment. Lovers of money, this greed that's inherent in our culture of everybody looking for the easy buck. Boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control. I see this all the time, just driving down the highway. We see expressions of all of these brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. Claiming the name, in many cases, the title of Christian and yet not living according to that instruction. We adults might be used to reading a scripture such as this, section of scripture such as this, and considering the world we face. But what about our youth? See, the caution for all of us in God's body, in His church, is that we not become like the frog in the proverbial pot. Because the world doesn't get bad all at once. It's fits and starts, isn't it? Boundaries get pushed. Old cultural norms get pulled away, and we become more and more used to the increasing immorality of the world around us. I think I've mentioned this story before. My grandfather, to use the term in the correct way, was a bastard. His parents never married. This is 1901. The family, most of the family, extended family, never knew this because he was raised by his aunt and uncle. And it was a shocking thing in that day to be saddled with that. It wasn't anything he did. But that was not tolerated. Look at the world we live in now, celebrated. I pulled down this statistics from the National Crime Prevention Council. I found this very troubling. For all types of crimes in the United States, for all types of crimes, people 12 to 19 are the most frequent victims. Any other age group? That's a sad thing to have to face a world so violent. School cultures have changed, mostly for the worse. Premarital sex is now firmly part of our entertainment culture. In fact, you're looked upon as weird if this is not something you embrace. Even more sad, deviant sexual perspectives are increasingly tolerated to the point where we have the same-sex marriage push that's going on all across the country now. And one of the interesting side effects from that is that you have groups of people that embrace a lifestyle, if you can use that word, such as pedophiles, that are now seeking equal acceptance. We're not there yet, but they use the same arguments as the same-sex marriage crowd. All of this reflects a course the world has chosen. Let's look at Proverbs 14. The problem is they've chosen a course apart from God. Proverbs 14 has a very interesting statement to this. Actually, the book of Proverbs mentions this a couple of times, I think, by way of reinforcement. Proverbs 14 and verse 12. There is a way that seems right to a man. See, the culture around us doesn't see a problem with this. What's the problem with vulgar lyrics? What's the problem with exposing my body? What's the problem with living outside of marriage? What's the problem with indulging in recreational drugs? And what's the problem with, and we go down the list. Notice the balance of the verse. But its end is the way of death. See, people aren't knowingly choosing death. They think they're choosing life, but they've chosen a path apart from God, and that only can end in death. Because look at the legacies of all of this. The broken homes, the broken families, the broken relationships, the greed, and everything that we read back in 2 Timothy. And in spite of that, mankind plows on, thinking, well, we'll make it happen sooner or later. This is the world we have. So to the second point now then, what can we as parents do? What can the older adults in this congregation do to help the youth? I have an interesting, thought-provoking quote here from Benjamin Franklin, who said, "Experience keeps a dear school, but fools will learn in no other way." See, we don't have to learn the mistakes ourselves. The better thing to do is to learn the mistakes of others. Malachi chapter 4 gives us a strong admonition. God does not take kindly to this disconnect between the generations, this disconnect within families. He's not pleased with this. And in Malachi 4 and verse 5, there's a very strong warning here. Malachi 4 and verse 5 says, "Behold, I will send to you Elijah the prophet, one like him, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the eternal." In other words, before it all goes off the rails, God is going to send a messenger with his message to tell everybody why it's going so badly. He says, before that, he says, "I'll send this Elijah. And he will turn," verse 6, "the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers." He feels so strongly about that, he says, "lest I come and strike the earth with a curse." Some translations have utter destruction. God knows this is not going to end well. And so he admonishes the families to step in. Now, we're not all related physically. Some of us, not at all. We're not biological families. But from God's perspective, that's irrelevant. He's made us his family. And we're required to do this. That's one of the things I appreciate being involved with in the camp program. We're trying very hard on that level to do these things. What that means is that we need to have continued and greater parental and even other adult participation in the lives of our kids, our youth, to show the positive impact they have. Oftentimes we can talk about the consequences of not living God's way, but what about the positive aspects, the blessings, the miracles, when God steps into our lives? This reference here in Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6, is a requirement from God. It's not a suggestion that we're to turn the hearts of the parents to their children and vice versa. The church gives great opportunity for that. All the activities we do together as family and the inclusiveness that we have and the expectation. You know, when we have camps, I mentioned this morning in Oshkosh, I would love to have every adult have the opportunity to go to one of the camps, to see what it's like, to sit in on the Bible classes and the Christian living and the what we call fireside chats, the conversations later in the evening, and even during the day, the memory verses that are promoted. Look at what we have as a church, what God has given to His people, as we heard in the sermonette. One day in seven, to think on or to think about something other than what's going on in our life right now. To think outside of ourselves. To think for the future. We are given time away from the pervasive influence of this world. Even though we're still in it, we can just turn it off for all day, at least one day, and walk away from it. Look at the time that we have to be with so many who believe in God's way of life and seek to implement that in their lives. The positive peer pressure, the validation that we have from each other. Proverbs 22:6. This was one of my early memory verses when I was a boy. For those of you not familiar with that story of mine, because it was on the paddle. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go. Establish the patterns very young. And when he is old, he will not depart from it. You could say that about virtually anything in life. We're looking at it from a spiritual perspective, but that could be work ethic. That could be value in education. It could be how you operate in a family. It could be any number of things, but the principle is to start young, to show even little children how right decisions are made, how they should choose properly, this matter of critical thinking that is disappearing from the culture around us. But not just having them jump into it, encouraging and assisting them in making right decisions. Giving them more responsibility for those decisions as they grow older. You know, do we make all of the decisions for our children in their lives? I've known some parents who do. They don't equip their children to do anything in the world. They've left them very vulnerable to others showing, teaching them something contrary. I came across an interesting quote from Eli Wiesel. He's a Jewish writer and a journalist. He's famous because he speaks a lot about the Holocaust. He had this short quote I found insightful. He says, "I preach and serve God not to change mankind, but rather to make sure they don't change me." That's very interesting to consider. What if we change that quote around a little bit and say, "I preach and serve God not to change my kids, but rather to show them God's way of life. To set the right example." I'll show you the importance. Here's some interesting facts. These come from a number of different sources. It's part of our jobs as parents and even adults, as I said, within the congregation, to establish and maintain a marriage and a positive home environment as God intended. The consequences are profound. This is from Thomas D. Cook. He wrote a little pamphlet on child development. He says, students living with both biological parents changed more positively during the course of the study than did other students in handling transitions from elementary school to middle school to high school. Intact family structures consistently predicted positive changes in the child's future. Something as simple as staying married having that profound an impact. Another article, Carolyn Tucker Halpern wrote this, Adolescent Health. Compared to teens with average intelligence, teens with high intelligence reported higher religious attendance. In other words, if you want smart kids, involve them in church. That flies in the face of so much that people would want to believe out there. One of the interesting corollaries to that is she said they also believe, that is these teens with higher intelligence, they also believe their parents are more disapproving of premarital sexual activity. Their parents don't agree with that. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 6, now before I share a few more of those with you. We need, in other words, whether we're talking about families, whether we're talking about a church environment, whether we're talking about adults encouraging other youth, we need to set the right example. That's Malachi 4. And it's interesting how much we've sacrificed at the altar of seeming inclusive to not have standards for our kids, to simply say, no, that's not acceptable, whatever it happens to be. Deuteronomy 6 and in verse 7, God speaking through Moses said, you shall teach them diligently, talking about his words, his commandments. He said, you shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. In other words, it's a regular part of your conversations. Just to talk about God and his way of life and his expectations as creator. From another media report, BJK&E media report, the average time the TV is on in the average U.S. home, any guesses on this? We're talking per day, 7 hours, 12 minutes. To contrast that, another study done by the American Family Research Council, the average time parents spend in meaningful conversations with their child, 38 minutes. Per day. That's not much more than an average sitcom. So 7 hours versus half an hour, who has the greater influence? Joshua chapter 24. Joshua assumed the mantle of leadership after Moses' passing as the children of Israel went into the promised land, into their new homeland. And he spent his life leading them. And he did an admirable job, but it was not his responsibility to make sure they did. All he could do was what any messenger of God could do, is preach the word and set the example. And he cautioned them at the end of his life that they had to make a decision, much like we read in Deuteronomy 30. Joshua 24 and in verse 15. He says, if it seems evil to you to serve the eternal, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Okay, if you think God is such a heavy-handed God, and this way of life is so onerous that you don't want to do this, you're still going to have to choose. You have to choose something. He says, whether it's the gods which your father served on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose lands you dwell, pick. He says, but as for me and my house, we will serve the eternal. Again, he makes it very clear. You can choose, but this is the right thing to choose. I found an interesting study done by the Washington State PTA group, and it's concerning parental involvement and the impact they have on their children in the school environment. They found that when parents are involved in their students' education, students achieve more. Then this is irregardless of socioeconomic status, ethnic or racial background, or the parents' education level. It cuts across all spectrums. The more parents are involved, the better the students do. They found that when parents are involved in their students' education, they score higher in their grades and their test scores. They do better in their attendance, they're absent from school less because they're more engaged themselves, and they more consistently complete homework, which means they're learning more. They're working through the material. Students whose parents are involved in their lives have higher graduation rates, greater enrollment rates in post-secondary education. the rather humorous quote here from an anonymous 14-year-old. He says, "I've learned that it's easier to stay out of trouble than to get out of trouble." You set the right course, and the right consequences come along. Let's turn next to Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah 30 is a prophetic chapter. You might recognize one of the sentences from that verse as we read it. Isaiah 30, we're not going to read the whole chapter, but in this chapter, God is talking about how the course Israel has set is a futile one. They've increasingly turned away from God, and they're looking towards their alliances. They're looking towards themselves to solve their problems. Verse 1, "Woe to the rebellious children, says the Eternal, who take counsel, but not of me." He says, you're listening to the wrong people, "who devise plans, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin." See, it's not too terribly bad to make a bad decision. We're all going to make bad decisions. The worst crime is to simply continue on, to double down, we might say, thinking if we give it more effort, more money, more time, it'll come out better. And it never does. And so he takes them to task for trusting in Egypt and Pharaoh and all of these other alliances. And look at what we've achieved. The money we've spent as a nation in these foreign countries. But we're not living a right lifestyle, so we can't condemn their lifestyles, their choices. They're happy to take our money. And when that runs out, then the alliance is done. So he talks to them, verse 8, "Go, write it down before them on a tablet, note it on a scroll, that it may be for a time to come and forever, that this is a rebellious children, a people, lying children, children who not hear the law of the Eternal, who say to the seers, the prophets, don't do that. We're not interested in hearing your words. And to the prophets, don't prophesy to us right things, verse 10, speak to us smooth things. Don't tell me what I need to hear. Tell me what I want to hear." Okay, you can have it all with no money down. And look at where we are. The average college graduate graduates not just with school payments, but with, in some cases, tens of thousands of dollars in personal debt as well. That puts you way behind even to begin with. And so God, in spite of all this correction, he tells them that there's coming a time when there's going to be a voice behind them saying, "This is the way, walk you in it." See, again, he's always giving us that reminder. You can choose, but I'm also going to remind you. Verse 20, "And though the Eternal gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore." The ones saying the right things, the ones seeking to direct the people, will no longer be marginalized, but your eyes shall see your teachers, your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, "This is the way, walk in it." And I envision that as a proactive thing, not waiting for them to make a bad decision and saying, "Well, this is the way you should have gone," but rather up front saying, "Okay, if you want this in life, if you want what God has to offer, this is the way to walk." Remember the 14-year-old? It's much easier to stay out of trouble than to get out of trouble. Don't go there to begin with. Are we doing this with our youth? As parents, as adults, as grandparents, whatever our station in life, are we helping that next generation? A few more statistics here. When parents are involved in their students, their children's education, rather, students exhibit more positive attributes and motivation towards school, and have a more positive self-concept and lower rates of suspension for disciplinary reasons. In other words, they're more settled. Student behavior such as alcohol use, violence, and antisocial behavior decrease as parental involvement in a child's life increases. They're not left to their own decisions. And the problem is not that they're children. The problem is that their brains are not mature. The human brain doesn't fully develop until sometime in the mid-20s. John D. Rockefeller Jr. had this quote I liked. He says, "I believe that every right implies a responsibility, every opportunity an obligation, every possession a duty." That's a much different view than the world around us now, isn't it? All right, lastly then, the positive influence of the church for our youth. What value does the church have for you? Well, I mentioned the camp program that we have. And for the United Youth Camp 2002-2012 season, we had 505 campers participate in that program over the year. They attended various camps. We have six, five summer camps, one winter camp. The average age was 14 to 15 years old. The main goal of camp, as listed by the campers, they're surveyed, their parents are surveyed, we're asking, what is it you valued? 92.4% of the campers stated the main goal was building positive relationships with other campers. There's a huge positive influence that comes from that peer pressure, that positive peer pressure. What was followed closely by that statement is that 89.6% of campers said they benefited from the Christian living content. They found value in the adults talking about God's Word. And 87.2% of the campers said that they attended camp to build a better relationship with God. See, the friendships are great. To be able to spend that time with others of like mind. In some cases, they're the only ones in their congregation. And to be able to go and build those friendships with other of their peer age is wonderful. But it's also very encouraging to me that they say they do this as well to build their relationship with God. The percentage of campers who attend camp year after year is 89%. They keep coming back. Matsuo Bashu had this quote, "Do not attempt to follow in the footsteps of your elders. Seek instead what they sought." See, my life growing up in the 60s is not going to be the life of a child growing up in the 2000s, 2010s. But the value of what we're to bring to this calling God gives us is the same. The goal is still the same. 1 Timothy chapter 4. One of the unfortunate legacies I mentioned that came out of the 1960s was what many call a generational gap. And what that meant in practice was that it created an adversarial relationship between youths and adults. And that's a shame. Because neither were able to learn from the other. Both thought they had the answers, and both dismissed both groups, and both ended up paying a price for that. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, Paul here is speaking in these letters to the young pastor Timothy. He's giving him insight. Because he's a young pastor. Some estimate that he was in his early 20s, just starting out in life in many regards, and yet responsible as a pastor to lead congregations. And so Paul's giving him advice here. And in 1 Timothy 4, verse 12, he tells Timothy, "Let no one despise your youth. Just because you're young," he says, "don't let people intimidate you." Now, he didn't tell Timothy to pretend that he knew everything either. He's just saying, make sure that the proper respect and decorum is there. But he reminds him, be an example. See, it doesn't matter what age you are, we hate hypocrisy, don't we? We hate people that are insincere. We want people to not only tell us what they believe, but if that's what they believe, to act on it, to follow through on it. So he says, don't let them despise your youth, but make sure you're an example. Notice, in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Everything you do and everything you are needs to reflect God's way of life. That's no different for the adults, is it? Church supports the youth, but the youth have a responsibility to step up as well. When I, as I mentioned, when my family came into the church, I looked at the list of deacons and elders and the men that were involved in responsibilities and the women taking care of different things, and I said, I'll never be involved. And things got so desperate, they made me a pastor. We've thinned out, haven't we, unfortunately, over the years. the responsibilities within the church now, we don't have the luxury, if you will, of saying, well, you have to be a certain age, a certain qualification. There are opportunities for youth in the church that I would have never dreamed that I would have had. But questions to the youth: are you rising to the challenge of rejecting the world around you? I know many are, but that's not a one-time event, unfortunately. It becomes a process that we have to continually be aware of. Are you drawing on the wisdom and experience of your parents and other older adults in the congregation to help make wise decisions? What should I consider in going to college? Should I go to college? If I do, what should I degree in? What kind of wife or husband should I be looking for? Things to consider long term. One of the greatest blessings I had later in as a young adult before my grandfather died was to be able to have those conversations with him, just to hear what his life was like, because I could see where that brought him. Again, to the youth, are you yielding to God and honoring your parents and seeking His will in life? There are spiritual principles that work just like gravity or just like any other aspect of physics that we're familiar with. When we follow God's instruction, when we choose those things, then positive consequences follow. Are you striving to be holy, in other words? It's a tall order, but it's doable, or God wouldn't ask it of us. Are you exploring the opportunities within church, whether it's camp, whether it's serving in your local congregation, or whether it's participating in some other way? You know, this is your church as well. Does it seem like that to you? In asking these questions, it's also fair for you young people to ask me a question. Why? Why should you care about anything that I've said today? Well, let's look at another example in 1 Kings 18. This is a very interesting story. If you haven't read it in a while, you can go back and read more of the context. We don't have time for that today. But in 1 Kings 18, we have here the story of Elijah. And if you remember the context, God had told Elijah to pray for no rain to fall. And for 3 years, the nation suffered under this. Ahab is the king. He was a terrible king. He was way too influenced by his pagan wife, Jezebel. And they did great harm to the nation. And so it comes down to this contest, if you remember the story, the priests of Baal. And Elijah let them go on all day pleading for Baal to intervene. And in some cases, it's humorous. You know, maybe he's asleep. He's not hearing you. Maybe he went to the bathroom. Call louder. You know, all of these different things. And so then after all of this, then Elijah has something to say. 1 Kings 18 and verse 21. Elijah came to all the people and he said, "How long will you falter between two opinions?" How long, I think it's the King James, it says, how long will you halt between two opinions? You're stuck. You don't know which way to go. Fork in the road. He says, how long will you stand there between two opinions? If the Eternal is God, follow Him. But if Baal, then follow him. Make a choice. Because even in not choosing, you've made a choice. And that's the worst choice to make. Because you have no say in what happens then. This is the same thing that Moses said to the nation. Choose. Why should you care about which choice you make in life? Because it will impact everything to follow. Not only in this physical life, but in the life to come. It will impact whether you're holy or not. It will impact whether you will be in the family of God or not. It will impact everything. Philippians 2, verse 14, excuse me, verse 15. Philippians 2 and verse 15. The world is more than willing to make the choice for you, but it's a poor choice. And it's a bad choice. It is a choice that will lead to death. God has called all of us, even the youth sitting here today, to a better way of life. In Philippians 2 and verse 15, Paul again writes, he says, that you become blameless and harmless. He's talking about taking on God's character. He says, so that you can become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. They might hate us, they might hate you because you don't go along with the social norms at school or the culture at your work or whatever it is. They may think that you're foolish for observing the things you do and setting aside the money in terms of tithes and offerings that you do. Or as they might see it, even the antiquated notions of morality that you hold to. They may disagree with all of those things, but they will not be able to fault your life. Because the world, as it says here, is going to be increasingly crooked and perverse. And it says, among whom you shine as lights in the world. You young people have a great opportunity to be part of a work now that will stretch into the millennium and beyond. And as much as we understand about that part of God's plan of salvation, I think when we experience the reality of it, we will be stunned at all that that will include. Because it will be so wonderful. Those of us who are parents, by extension grandparents as well, have a great responsibility to raise godly children and to help them establish the habit of righteous choices, to not let them drift in the world around us. The older adults in this church as well have an obligation to pass on godly wisdom, to interact, to share, and to direct to encourage the following generations. Lastly, let's go back to Deuteronomy 30 and end there as well. Deuteronomy 30 and in verse 19. I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you, or before you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. We have a great responsibility to choose before us. And God here says, therefore, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. We are surrounded by a world that increasingly rejects God. But now is the time for all of us, young and old, to make our calling sure and to choose this day.